And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends who've been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, someone once told us that if we stuck with D&D, everything would turn out okay. Hi, I'm Ange, and life comes at you pretty fast if you're not paying attention. One day, you're a senior in high school getting asked if you want to play D&D by the cute new kid, and the next thing, you've got a mortgage, several cats, and are running way too many games.
I'm Jared. I've written stuff recently, but I don't want to say that too loud because I don't want to scare myself out of doing it again. You can find some of my previous articles at gnomestew.com and whatdoinknowjr.com, and someday you may see more. After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about metagaming, why it has a bad reputation, and why it's actually unavoidable and necessary for the best gaming possible. Then we'll have some of our recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
In 1977, the first Dungeons & Dragons basic set came out. Now, this was intended to be the introduction to the hardcover Advanced Dungeons & Dragons rulebook. From 1983 until 1993, Dungeons & Dragons had multiple box sets that took characters from 1st to 36th level, included rules for Divine Ascension, and provided an extremely detailed setting, Mystara. Unlike Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, it often used rules introduced in earlier supplements, like the skill system, using the same system in later products instead of recreating the wheel every time similar rules came up in later products. Setting material was standardized, including a player section letting players know what their characters would know from where they had come from. In many ways, D&D was more intuitive than any D&D and was just as mechanically robust. Now, one of the strangest things that D&D hung on to for its entire existence was presenting species as classes, meaning that the fighter and magic user were classes, as were elf and halfling. D&D was more advanced than AD&D at biological determinism. Now, that isn't a compliment. I just want to make clear, that is not a compliment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
There have been three sessions of D&D-ish games since we last spoke. Jared will talk about his game, so I am going to go on and talk about my other two. First, City of Cowls actually did happen. It wasn't in person like we had hoped, but the GM was able to pull together enough energy to still run a session. In the game, we had made it to the Gashkorum, the gathering place of the Dragonborn clans, and established friendly relations with two of the three clans that were already there. There were still two clans unaccounted for, so we ended up choosing to go try and find them and bring any survivors to the Gashkorum so we could basically do the thing, unite the clans. Of the two left, there were the Red Vipers and the Striking Cobras. We were most worried about the Striking Cobras because they were the clan that Rhee had been promised to, but when she arrived, she challenged the leader, her supposed to be future husband, to a duel and killed him, earning herself exile. So we chose to go do the Red Vipers first because we figured the Striking Cobras were going to be a mess. In the Red Viper territory, we first found a small group in a standoff with some demons that we jumped in to help them. We found out that they had been separated from their quorum, their leader, so we healed them up and sent them in the direction of the Gashkorum and then went off to find the leader and any other survivors. Upon finding them, Rhee was actually able to impress the leader enough that they pledged themselves to her cause. She was able to get a lucky roll on her charisma check because she's a barbarian. She really... I'm not going to say charisma's her dump stat, but charisma is her dump stat. She did have advantage on the roll, though, because she had already gathered enough strength from the other clans that we had already rescued and brought together and so on. From there, the leader of the Red Vipers took his people and headed toward the Gashkorum, and we set off to head towards the Striking Cobras, well, looking for any stragglers from the Red Vipers. We thought we might have found some, but they turned out to be the possessed bodies of those Dragonborn and a Merilith. So we had a fun fight, but we were sad that we couldn't save more of the Red Vipers. But it is what it is. It's a demonic invasion. There's gonna be casualties. The funny thing is we camped out after that, and we had kind of grumbled that we wish we had horses. None of us are the type of spellcasters that have, like, summon steed or anything like that that would get us enough horses to make the journey across the, you know, the desert plains quicker. But when we woke up that morning, there was basically some riding lizards sitting there, saddled up and waiting for us, suspiciously, with the same color patterns as Bahamut. We decided to just look up at the sky and say, thanks, you know, thanks, Dad. And then basically get on them and make our way to the Striking Cobras. With the Striking Cobras, we had done some spells to try and have a feel for what we were heading into, and we knew they had, I won't call it a fort, but they had like a holdout position in a canyon that they could defend and keep their people safe. So we arrived into the canyon and approached without hiding. Rhee was wearing the panoply of the gold, the armor that makes her a representative of Bahamut and is supposed to give her the, you know, the right to lead the clans. So we're all on edge. You know, these are the people that she killed their leader many years ago and got exiled, and we don't know what their attitude is going to be like. The quorum, basically, of that clan came out, took one look at her, and said, "You are Faraday. You killed our quorum, but you wear the panoply of the gold. We are yours." That was it. Instantly done. Apparently, their wise woman had been having visions for years since Rhee left that she was going to return in the panoply of the gold, and that was going to be the salvation of the Dragonborn. And we were all like, okay, how soon are you guys going to be ready to go? We should probably get moving. As we started making our way back towards the Gesh Quorum, we had been doing these sending chains with people in these places to stay on top of who was where, doing what. And we found out that one of the clans, the one that hadn't pledged itself to Rhee yet, was basically making a power play to try and take over what was left of the other clans, so that when Rhee came back, she'd have no say. So we split the party. Three of us stayed with the Striking Cobras to continue back, and Rhee, Kai, and Modrin basically got on a rock. There was a feather token of something or another that created a rock that they could all fly to the Gesh Quorum, and the party's going to be split when we start next session, which is always going to be fun. Never listen to your GM when they say don't split the party.
Don't listen to your GM when he say don't split the party when it's for your own safety. Do listen when they've reached their mental limit and they can't quite juggle having multiple parties going at the same time.
That is true. That is true. There is a limit here, but, and actually I shouldn't say the GM. The GM is usually fine with it. It's the other players that start panicking. Oh God, we can't split the party. No, do split the party. This makes for some interesting stuff sometimes. So in the Margreave game, we opened with Samirza, the devil that wanted Nevrim's pact, at their camp, demanding his signature in blood, along with several imps there threatening the whole party. This was treated as a fight, but it was mostly meant to be a dramatic showdown between Samirza and the forest for Nevrim's soul. Nevrim, of course, refused, so she started having her imps try and kill his friends. They never attacked him once. The funny thing was, is the players, they still tried to attack her. She was a CR-12 Aranyes, so a little bit out of their second level league, but, you know, they were going to try, and it gave me for some dramatic moments, like when Tervin is wild-shaped into a giant owl, tried to steal the contract out of the air. The contract was just an illusion. It wasn't actually there, but he tried to steal it, and in doing that attack, I said she got her counterattack and basically knocked him out of owl form in one hit and took several hit points of his own as he tumbled to the ground. My goal here was that the first time one of his friends went down, Baba Magori would appear as an agent of the forest to intervene on its behalf, allowing for it to have a conversation with Nevrim. They did surprisingly well on keeping people up, so it ended up being around the third round when I had her appear after Samira's turn. I had Samira get tangled up in the forest, like grabbing her and pulling her out of the fight, while Nevrim also got more gently grabbed and pulled out of the fight so he could have a conversation with the forest and let the players continue the fight with the imps. It was actually kind of fun role-playing as the forest, because I very clearly said there were no words, just thoughts, feelings, and an offer. And Nevrim accepted and then basically pleaded to be let go so he could go help his friends. In the end, they killed all of the imps, but Zartath went down, Grish only had a couple of hit points left. I think Turvin had about half his hit points. And Baba Magori banished Samirza, and Nevrim was now a warlock with a pact of the Elderwood. It was a lot of fun to set it up to help the character have this moment, because he wanted to play a warlock, but he didn't really like either of the pacts that were available in the original book. So he asked if he could play a reluctant warlock. Now, mind you, the player has never played Baldur's Gate 3, so he is completely unfamiliar with Will's storyline. I stole the whole thing from Will Ravengard in Baldur's Gate 3, but it ended up working really well, especially since by the time we got to them getting to third level, the new pact was out. They're still going to have this demon who wants, you know, retribution for all of this, but whatever. The game after that got a bit derailed as they took an hour plus to level their characters. And I had tried to get them to tell me which subclasses they wanted ahead of time so I could make sure they were loaded into Shard properly. But Woody didn't tell me that he was actually choosing bees for Turvin until a day we were playing. So I never got a chance to load in the bees subclass for the druids. So whatever. We had a little bit more role playing as they continued traveling, and Lila, the girl that had slept with the bees, was starting to wake up. And, you know, they're all like, well, what do you want to do? I mean, the girl is 12. She spent the last 50 years sleeping in a beehive. She has no idea what she wants. So I think Zartath kind of picked up on it, because he's like, look, we're going to go some places. You can keep coming with us. If you decide one of these places is where you want to stay, we're good. The next session is going to pick up in Zobek with them having downtime as I set up the next adventure. So that was my stuff.
We collected so many orphans in our Tales of the Old Margrave game. It's just all over the place in the woods there.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned because I'm going to have an interlude adventure, but the next main adventure they pick up on deals with some orphans as well. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is right on the heels of Lila. So we'll see if they complain about that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it gives you some time to think maybe there is a thread that you can come up with about children and things of that nature. And
yeah,
in our game, it kind of worked thematically with the idea that the halfling warlock that had a pact with Baba Yaga was orphaned because her village was attacked by ghouls and Baba Yaga basically took her in. So there was kind of that recurring, like, can I help these children in ways that don't permanently scar them the way Baba Yaga did to me?
Yeah. Not a good foster mom.
No, not really.
Sure, she tried her best. Probably not, but...
Speaking of things like Baba Yaga, the Mists of Ravenloft have obscured all scheduling, and it has been impossible to actually get a date for my Ravenloft game. Actually, I take that back. Just today, we figured out what day in June we're actually going to play. We're going to still be down a player, which is sad, but basically we've decided we have 6 people. If we get 4 on any given Saturday, we're going to go ahead and run with it because we want to make sure that we're actually making progress and we don't just drift apart. But I really am hoping to get more sessions where I can get all 6 of them there at one time.
Yeah, I think most groups should determine that level of how many players down means canceling a session, how many players are we willing to run with. And of course, you still end up with the issues of, we were about to head into that storyline, and they're not here.
I usually kind of go with one more than half, you know, enough that it's more than, or 50% plus one, I should say. So, but we did get to play the Midgard game, which is the 2014 D&D game. And we also got to play the monthly, quote unquote, Thrones and Bones Tales of the Valiant game last Saturday as well.
Oh, yeah, that means I lied. I had 4 D&D-ish games.
So in our Midgard game, the players continue to explore the complex that was created by this elven mastersmith who turned against his king and managed to get himself Cask of Amontillado'd into the bowels of the fortress.
Because he was a racist.
He is. You're not wrong. The PCs heard a few more anti-human rantings from the dead mastersmith, and then they encountered a salamander that he had bound into the weapon forge that he was using, and the salamander was going to attack until it realized that maybe if they can purge this place of the mastersmith, then it will finally be free. So it is inclined to help them at this point. They made their way into the weapons vault where all of the finished weapons were, you know, get loaded up and wait there for a while, which is where the dragon slaying spear that the mastersmith denied his king because his king was no longer worthy of it, where he kept that spear. And it turns out that he is cursed to roam his previous home as a Death Knight. Even though it's a 2014 game, I like using a lot of the 2024 monsters because they did make some neat adjustments to some of them. And we got to play with the idea that you can have Death Knights of different CRs now. So we had the lower CR Death Knights with the full-on Death Knight, and a party of four 12th level characters can handle that. It was a little rough, but it wasn't as close as some of the fights that we've had recently.
It wasn't as rough as they wanted to make it seem like it was. I think there was only a comment about making a party amongst twice.
Yes. That's how you can tell how close the fight has got. One of the things they realized when they understood that they were dealing with Death Knights is that somehow the sin that causes them to be bound to the mortal plane has to be resolved, or else they just keep coming back. So now they need to explore the rest of the area to figure out exactly what sin it is that is binding the Master Smith to his halls, more so than just being a racist jerk.
Yeah, that's a pretty big sin in my opinion.
It is, it is. But there is something worse that he did, and you'll get to find that out eventually. I do.
See, I thought we'd explored the whole complex.
Oh no, there's still more.
Okay then.
But I like telling a story with a dungeon, you know, where people find out a little bit of the story from each room. I'm not against dungeons that just kind of have rooms that sort of make sense but might be dangerous or whatever, but I do kind of like that feel when you can get a nice, tightly told story just from, we went to this room and found this out, we went to this room and found this out. So I'm hoping that's coming through in this particular dungeon.
Yeah. Dungeon ecology is important.
Yes.
It has to make sense for me. I mean, yeah, sure, when I was a kid, wandering a dungeon that had goblins in one room, a gelatinous cube in another, and an ogre in another room, yeah, it was fun. But nowadays, I'm like, why is any of this here? I'm like Sigourney Weaver in Galaxy Quest. Why is this here? Who made this?
You could just, like, cheat like Halaster in Undermountain, where it's just like, he's just amused by putting portals into random places to drop monsters into the place.
Yeah.
Can't do that with every single dungeon that you run into, though.
Yeah, but even then, with Undermountain, at least the levels make some sense.
Yeah, there's like a theme.
Like, internally to themselves, they make a, like, they have a theme. It's like Halaster's Twisted Amusement Park dungeon.
It is, basically. Halaster, yeah. World. We also, I think we had a lot of fun in our Thrones and Bones game. We spent a lot of time role-playing, and a lot of that was like, the PCs spent a lot of time in Stokely's Hall, which is the tavern where everyone congregates in the city. Not only did they get to kind of role-play how they fit in the town after they've been here for about a month with all of them being Outlanders, but they got to kind of contrast that rowdy crowd with the kind of rowdy crowd that's in the Jarl's place, which is a different, more important person rowdy crowd, but still also a rowdy crowd.
It's a little more dignified. It's rowdy, but dignified.
It is. What I liked was they could have been two very similar scenes, and it still felt like they were distinct enough that it was fun to play through both of them. But in the Jarl's Hall, they ran into a priest of the Allfather that was insinuating that the Jarl may have lost the favor of the gods, and that just rubbed Dawn, our paladin, the wrong way, to where she was getting in his face and asking him if he was challenging his Jarl's right to rule and if he wanted to fight her, and Fuega, our druid, kind of talked her down a little bit. It was fun. I liked that whole interaction, but basically, the PCs are going to find a situation that may help resolve all of this that the priest of the Allfather is assuming is a sign of the gods' displeasure.
Yeah. I figured Dawn she's a paladin. I think it's a devotion, and it's the, you are there to do right, you are there to protect people, and this guy was obviously trying to undermine the Jarl, and he was doing it in a way that was incredibly insulting. And while Dawn has a lot of charisma and a lot of wisdom, she does not have a whole lot of intelligence. So she could tell what this guy was doing, and had the charisma to stand up for him, but not necessarily the smarts to know when to back down or how this might affect things in the long run.
I like it because Fuega is the creepy witch outsider, but this was one of those instances where she understood the situation better than Dawn did.
Yeah.
So the PCs started exploring the sea cave that was under the bay. They got into a cavern that has an air pocket, and they fought a really nasty swarm of fish that had like this oozing slime that was poisonous coming out of their teeth. There are a few of us in this group that don't love thinking about the potential of drowning and tension around that story element. More than one of us does not like playing video games when you have that timer and you're underwater and it just looks too realistic and you have that stress going because it just reminds you too much of what that actually would be like. But what I liked is the adventure pretty much tells you there are air pockets. It should not really be a challenge for them to get from one air pocket to another to explore this place. It's more getting to use underwater elements in a way that isn't overly onerous to run, because that can be that can be troublesome sometimes in D&D.
Yeah. I was very much like, can we get access to water breathing, potions of water breathing? Can we? And it's like, no, you don't need it. You don't need to worry about it. Because I'm like, we're a little bit of a low level for an underwater adventure, aren't we? We only just hit third level.
It's more of an underwater air pocket cavern adventure. But yeah, it is an adventure that doesn't require you to be fully underwater, but gets to play with some of those tropes. So I'm looking forward to exploring a little bit more of it when we actually get something scheduled next time, which I think we actually may already have a date for next month, too. I am shocked.
Yeah, it is. This is my shocked face.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
So moving on into the Dungeon Master's Workshop, metagaming is one of those hot button topics that gets people all worked up when it comes up in conversation. Talk to some people in the RPG communities and it's the most egregious sin someone could ever commit. Others, like your host tonight, consider it to be an unavoidable and necessary aspect of D&D and games like it. We're going to dig down into the topic and figure out what it all means. So let's start off with what exactly is metagaming.
So I would say metagaming is when a player uses knowledge about the game rules or the setting that their character would not know in order to inform their decisions.
Yep. That is pretty much exactly what it is. That is the straight up definition without putting any values on whether that's good or bad on it. It's knowledge about the game rules or the setting that the player knows that the character might not. Do the official rules of D&D or any related games say anything about metagaming?
I had a hard time finding the specific term metagaming. But I think there's a reason for that, and that is metagaming does have a negative connotation to it. And what a lot of games say now when they are talking about the positive aspects of it, which, you know, are what we're going to be bringing up, they usually frame it more in terms of like player principles or, you know, the things that we are working towards in this game. So it is metagaming because it is talking about genre awareness. But it is not calling it metagaming because metagaming has turned into this really evil, horrible, nasty word for things.
Yeah, I would say, historically speaking, metagaming has been considered bad since probably before you and I both started playing. You know, it's been this term used to describe players doing things that they probably shouldn't because they know the game. If you think about it, back in the day, first edition, and I think second edition, they told you to not let the players read the Dungeon Master's Guide. I was told flat out when I started playing, I was not allowed to look at the Dungeon Master's Guide ever.
If you listen to our last podcast, our Bardic College was about what the first edition DMG said, which was basically saying that it is a deed not worthy of an honorable death for a player to read the player's hand or the Dungeon Master's Guide. And you should charge them more for things in game and take away their magic items if they do it. Because, of course, you don't want to have discussions like an adult.
Oh, my God. Side tangent. Note right up front, do not solve player problems with in-character consequences. Please, for the love of God, stop trying. Anyway, let's get into why was it considered such a cardinal sin? Why was it possibly the worst thing you could do as a player?
I think in earlier editions of the game, it probably did have a little bit more of a negative overall effect on the people playing, because a lot of times what metagaming meant there was, here is this tricky puzzle, but I know where this puzzle came from, so I'm going to use my knowledge of reading it in the newspaper last week, and I'm going to solve the puzzle, and nobody else at the table gets to engage with this. I am smarter than all of you because I saw where this puzzle came from. It was that sort of thing that kind of ruined, quote-unquote, the kind of adversarial thing that you had going on in a lot of adventures.
Yeah, I think that's it right there. When this started becoming considered a sin, a problem, it was because it felt like the player was cheating. They were using knowledge they probably shouldn't have had to do things in game that circumvented what the Dungeon Master was trying to do. And in those days, the game was, frankly, a lot more adversarial. It was the GM, you know, like we still talk about today, asking the player, where did the GM hurt you? Show me where the GM hurt you on the doll, because you're so afraid of letting the GM know what you're trying to do. Or you're so afraid the GM's going to screw you over just because they know what you're trying to do. A lot of that from back in the day were players trying to be clever enough to circumnavigate what the GM was putting in front of them. And sometimes if you had knowledge of what the rules said or what the stats were for a monster or how a puzzle worked because you've already read the module, you could maybe get by it a lot quicker and, you know, screw that GM who was trying to kill your character.
Unless this sounds like something that was too far in the past, it was still a big deal when Adventurers League in the 2014 rules, they went years before they let people replay scenarios because of that feeling that if you've already played a scenario and you play it again, you're going to ruin it for everybody, which it's possible, but also be an adult.
Yeah, be an adult. I bring up a lot the troll problem. Trolls are vulnerable to fire. You need to hit them with some sort of fire to permanently kill them. I am tired of playing characters that have to play dumb about that fact. Because I have played D&D for so many decades at this point. It's like, why can't we just say our characters know this? I'm not trying to cheat. It's a troll. We know this.
And the funny thing about that is, the more detailed certain settings got, the more that was even kind of absurd. Because there is literally a troll wall around Waterdeep because of the Troll Wars, where trolls tried to ravage Waterdeep, and everyone in Waterdeep knows this story, and nobody is going, what did they use to fight the trolls? No, everybody knows they used fire to fight the trolls.
So if people abuse it and it's considered cheating, why would we ever say it's a good thing?
Because sometimes if somebody is not trying to win the game, if somebody is not trying to upstage someone else, knowing things like genre and how things are supposed to play out, knowing things like how the setting actually works, and understanding that maybe your character is going to do something that they shouldn't do because you're actually playing against that in order to create tension, that's all actually really good things that can come from metagaming.
Ultimately, we know we're playing a game. That is absolutely unavoidable. So let's be honest about that fact. It's like, it is okay to admit we are playing a game, and there is a certain level of metagaming that is required to make a efficient, tactically oriented character, to make a powerful character. Now, I'm not saying everyone should focus on that, and you can get the power gamers that get a little annoying with trying to make their character the most powerful thing ever possible, but there is a happy middle ground of understanding how the mechanics of the game work that is required to have fun at D&D. There's also, as Jared said, understanding the genre, being able to help advance the narrative of the game, understanding what might be expected of you as the GM is laying the plot down in front of the players. Oh, okay, this is where we're probably going to end up going because I think this is where this story is leading. It also really helps to be able to integrate your story elements with the story elements of the other characters. That is a level of metagaming that is powerful and good for all role-playing games. Being able to say, you know, like, oh, okay, my character is gonna would do this, but it would probably be more fun if I can convince that other character to come with me because it'll help their storyline as well. You know, this is all metagaming. It's all thinking about the game beyond the character on the page in front of you.
And I will give an example that I think probably would have been better for a lot of people back in the day. If you hand somebody just the player description of what a Kender is like in Dragonlance, and have them play based on that couple paragraphs explaining what a Kender is and gives their game stats, you are going to get somebody that plays a Kender probably a lot different than somebody that has read all the Dragonlance novels, realizes that Tasselhoff and just about every other Kender that shows up that is a main character acts like a Kender, but maybe at about 75 or 50%, not 100% all the time. And they understand then it's like, okay, you wait until the right moment to do the Kender stuff. You don't do it all the time. And that is a metagaming
thing. If you think about it, it's Kenders and Paladins. There are today, in 2025, still people that do not want to play in a game if another player is playing a Paladin. Because there were so many people playing Paladins back in the day that would just be a jerk about it. This is what my character would do. And screw things over, rather than being able to take a step back and go, okay, I'm playing a lawful good paladin. I'm not supposed to, you know, allow bad, you know, like crime or that type of thing to happen, but I'm going to screw over the rogue player's fun if I try and squash them every time they try and use one of their roguely abilities. So I'm just going to say my character didn't notice. It's metagaming for good.
And there's also this is another element that I think is interesting because, and I saw this all the way into third edition, and that is DMs were almost encouraged to not tell your paladin players what they were going to do that the DM thought broke their paladin-like vows and suddenly screwed them over and forced them to go on a quest to get their powers back. And that whole situation works so much better if the DM willingly pulls the player in with some metagaming and says, if you do X, that's going to break your vow. I'm just letting you know now. I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm saying I want you to decide to make an informed decision whether or not you want to do it. I'm not trying to screw you over by playing gotcha.
Yeah, some of that gets into the other mantra I have, respect the competency of the characters. Because if you have a paladin who has this duty, they've trained, they've studied, they've given their oaths, they should have an idea of what type of things they should avoid doing to screw themselves over. You don't want to play a gotcha game based on the player knowledge when the character would be a lot smarter about it. So talking about the characters being smarter and players knowing stuff, what about when the players know things that their characters wouldn't? We kind of talked about the troll thing.
I think sometimes, like you were saying there, one thing that earlier D&D didn't necessarily tell you to do is to respect the competency of the players. You were kind of supposed to assume that somehow this person became a competent first level fighter without knowing anything other than to poke people with a longsword. Even though this world probably has its own myths and legends and stories, somehow they can't draw from those to infer what's going on until they literally see it in front of them.
Now, it's one thing if you are trying to play a game where the characters are nobodies, they're peasants from a farm that pick up weapons to defend themselves, and you're running some sort of OSR style game, like that's one thing, but most games are not that is a specific subgenre of these style of games. Most D&D games, the characters come into it with skills and history and experience in the world. I would just ask the players, so how does your character know this info? How did they learn it? Put it back on them for them to spin it into the story of how their character has this knowledge. Because, as we mentioned, the world is going to have myths and legends.
And sometimes it is a matter of, it's not that you don't want someone to do something. It's that you want there to be more texture than just that this person knows exactly what to do whenever something comes up.
Right. Tell me honestly that if a werewolf showed up in front of you, well, if a werewolf showed up in front of you, you're kind of screwed. But tell me, if you actually saw a werewolf across the street, you wouldn't think, man, I need a silver bullet.
Yeah, exactly.
These legends exist. These myths exist. Let the world have some life and breathe in it.
What's really interesting about that when you bring it up is that you see this contrast a lot. And I am put in this mindset because of watching Nosferatu that came out last year. In that era, vampires were not well known in Western Europe. That was that was kind of why Stoker picked that as a topic for this. This is this thing that's like an Eastern European myth that he's bringing over into Western Europe that nobody knows anything about. So some of it he's drawing from and some of it he's just making up himself. So when you watch those stories and you see people go, how do they not know to put a stake through their heart? It's because vampires weren't really a cultural thing there. But when you tell a story in the modern day and somebody doesn't know to put a stake through a vampire's heart, then you're stretching credulity quite a bit.
And this is not to say that you can't change things up if you want to put a fresh spin on some of this stuff. It is okay to change the thing that will kill the troll. They're fighting, I don't know, ice trolls, and it's actually force damage that'll kill it. Now, I don't know, but I'm just saying you can put different spins on these to give it like a fresh flavor, but don't do it just to screw your players over.
And there are degrees of that too. Like, for example, in Barovia in Curse of Strahd, Strahd can be outside when it's just overcast because he is the master of the domain. Unless it is full bright on sunlight, which it never is in Barovia, he can be outside. But that's not necessarily true of, like, vampire spawn.
Right.
Like, that is telling a story about why Strahd is different than these other vampires you've run into.
So one of the arguments I've heard against the type of metagaming we're talking about is that it ruins the immersion of being your character in a game. So how do we address that when somebody is saying that it ruins trying to achieve immersion in a game?
Do you mean how do we address that without stopping and doing another entire episode trying to grasp the concept of immersion and then bringing that back into this discussion?
I actually did an article on this crap about 9 years ago on Gnome Stew called The Illusion of Immersion. And what I was saying is that in general, immersion is not something that you maintain for an entire four-hour session. People are not talking in character for an entire session, unless maybe you're playing a LARP. You might be able to get that level of immersion and being your character almost 100% of the time when you're playing a LARP and you're actually physically play acting as that character. But in most tabletop RPGs, I'm not saying that trying to hit some of those moments of immersion isn't good and fun and some of the stuff we strive for, but saying that any level of thinking about the game beyond thinking about your character is bad is kind of missing the point of the games we all play.
I will do you one better than all of that, he said in his Drax voice. There is a certain thing that we all understand from ingesting media that for some reason, when we look at role-playing games, we don't internalize. And that is, we will watch a horror movie and we will say that we are immersed in that horror movie. And what does that horror movie do? It does things like having a soundtrack. Like, you can tell from the music what's going to happen. You know what? A human being in the story would not hear the soundtrack, but you are immersed because the soundtrack is helping to tell the story.
God help you if that soundtrack is diegetic and in the story.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. Although I love a good twist when you think that the music isn't diegetic and then you find out that it is for some reason.
It's total tangent, but my brother hates musicals. He absolutely adores the Pitch Perfect movies. And you know why? Because the music is diegetic. They're actually singing it in character as part of, you know, it's not like they're suddenly breaking into song. They're actually performing as those characters.
They give you this tiny, ridiculous reason to suspend disbelief.
Yep. And that's enough.
Yeah. And that's also another good point is it is hard to hit everyone's triggers for what keeps them immersed and what knocks them out of something. Like you said, that is a whole other thing because, like, I can watch Moulin Rouge and be into it. That doesn't throw me off that they're all singing. In fact, I think it's hilarious. But yeah, it is. Some people, it's just not going to work.
And I think there's this, like, the bad side of trying to achieve total immersion is the player who is an absolute pain to have at the table or to play with because I'm doing what my character would do. It's what my character would do. Well, if your character's a dick, stop being that. It's like that level of immersion when it starts negatively impacting the game for everyone else is a problem.
Bringing up another Dragonlance example, Raistlin turning on everybody so that he can be the hero later on is great in a novel. Does not work at the table very well. Abandon everybody because it's what my character would do. That's great. You can leave the gaming group now.
Well, you know, it, like, that type of thing could work if, A, the player is having that character, so they're not doing that and then expecting to still be able to continue playing that character concurrently with everyone else. And B, you kind of get everyone else's buy-in on it, i.e., doing a little bit of metagaming to talk with the other players to say, hey, this is going to happen, or prepping them to know that it's going to happen and not springing it on them out of the blue and causing all sorts of strife, both with the players and the characters. Is what's happening? Why is this character leaving us? What's going on?
I have mentioned this character before, and unfortunately it didn't work as well as I would have liked in game, but in a Star Wars game, I was playing an Athorian Padawan who had survived Order 66, and we were like this last group of Padawans that just happened to be on a ship that was guarding artifacts when it happened. So we're running from everything in the galaxy. And I told the GM and the table, I want to have a dark side arc where he goes dark and then gets redeemed. And I kind of want it to be because he wants to defend the people that he cares about. Not like some grandiose, I want to rule the galaxy, but I have seen too many people I care about die, and I'm not going to let it happen again. And he was a healer. So that was going to be like this big, like, the first time he used the dark side power is like the reverse of the healing power, where it's like scrambling somebody's mm-hmm. organs. And I wanted that because I understand the meta arc in Star Wars, that one of those big story arcs is the redemption arc from the dark side. We ran into an artifact of Exar Kun, which my character had no idea who Exar Kun is. Me, I know. So I was playing with that evil Sith holocron because I know exactly who that character was, and I could play my characters being completely stupid about who that character was.
So what do you do if you are having a problem with somebody at the table who is abusing the stuff they know as a player but shouldn't know as a character? I.e., what happens if you end up with that bad side of metagaming at the table?
We already kind of alluded to it, and that is sometimes you need to stop everything and talk to people outside of the game. And when I say outside of the game, I don't necessarily mean we're going to end the game and we're all going to go across the street to Steak and Shake and then we'll have a discussion. I just mean we're not rolling dice right now. Nobody's playing their characters. I need to talk to you one-on-one about this before this goes any further.
Yeah, I think this falls into the same category as any other problem player behavior. It's like you got to have a conversation with them. You're not going to be able to truly fix it by doing stuff to them in game. You're not going to be able to correct bad behavior without a conversation to say, hey, man, hey, lady, this is, you know, I kind of need you to stop doing that. You know, if you think your character should know something that you know, but the character doesn't, ask me. Say, hey, would my character know this? And maybe we can come up with a reason why you know it, or maybe you can make a roll. My players do that all the time. Hey, do I know anything about this? Do we know anything about these types of demons? Do I know anything about this type of thing in the forest? I don't know. Make a roll. We'll see if you know anything. And the players love sometimes when they roll that one and get to play an absolute idiot about the topic. Other players are super stoked when they roll an 18 and be like, yes, I can use my knowledge.
That is a whole other interesting thing, because that kind of, in part, came about in third edition, where it's like, we're going to give you rules for when you can metagame. If you roll high enough with this knowledge check, we will let you have a little bit of metagaming as a treat. But what's interesting to me, though, is when you quantify it too much as a rule like that, when it's not in the DMG saying, let your players know something once in a while, or if it's borderline, let them make a check, then it becomes a hard and fast rule that people expect. And then you fall into this thing where it's like, there is this monster that there is no reason anyone on this planet knows anything about. But because a DC 30 religion check is supposed to tell you about, you know, extremely rare undead, people would roll that and say, what do I know about it? I was like, oh, well, magically, you know about this thing that nobody in the universe has ever seen before.
I mean, that's one of those points where you as the GM need to develop the understanding of when to say you can't roll for this. You've never heard of it. You don't know anything about it. All of your studying, respect the competency of the characters. The players need to respect there are things their character isn't going. It kind of goes both ways there. And I will generally only let them roll when I don't care if they know some stuff. But if this is a thing they've never heard of, never seen, you don't get to roll for that. But it takes time as a GM to understand when to not let the rolls, because you can, you always want to respect the player agency. You want to let the players roll the dice, and then you let them roll and you're like, oh crap.
Yeah.
I don't want to give them this information, but they just got a nat 20.
I was just about to say, you know, don't make the person that grew up in Waterdeep make a check to know if they understand that trolls don't like fire.
Yeah, that's the thing, too, is understand who these characters are, where they're from, and kind of honor that occasionally. In the old Margrave game, Dahlia and Turvin are a ranger and a druid, respectively. They know more stuff about the forest. Even if Zartath might have a better nature role, he's the city kobold. He doesn't know all the nature stuff that those two are going to know because they lived it and breathed it. Respect that.
I will say another thing that I saw, because I have seen both in Pathfinder Society and Adventurers League, the kind of metagaming that comes from people replaying adventures. In there, I think some of the best things that you can do in those circumstances is to say, I don't care that you've played this before. Don't make any of the big decisions in the party. Let somebody else make the big decisions. Mm-hmm. Or even, like, if everybody gets stumped, then you can come in and have an idea if you can explain to me why you know this. But don't lead the party. Don't be the person that's taking them from place to place, saying, we need to open this door. Oh, there's a trap over there. I'm fine with you understanding all of this stuff, but let other people take the lead, make the decisions. And then once in a while, I'll point to you and let you know, okay, go ahead and let some of that metagaming fly there.
Yeah, I recently had this happen. It wasn't a D&D game. It was a Savage Worlds East Texas University game. My friend needed another player at the table. I didn't think I had played this scenario before, but once we got started, I'm like, oh, I know this one. And so I played along and I kept the knowledge that I had about what was actually going on to myself and let the other players drive the game forward, and only kind of stepped in when I knew it would be safe and not impinge upon their discovery of the story of the game as we played. And I still had a ton of fun.
And what's funny,
even if what was going on and who was screwing with who and what the big bad was and why things were happening.
And the fun thing about that is sometimes when you aren't pushing for things to happen the same way they happened when you played through this, sometimes it is fun to see the same adventure that you were in and people making different decisions and how it makes this thing, like the outline of this thing is the same, but this resolved a whole different way just because you let other people make some of the big decisions in the adventure. When we were in John's Storm King's Thunder game, I have run that adventure from beginning to end, and I talked to him about that at the beginning. I was like, I'm not going to reveal anything about any plot things that I understand, but at the same time, Jared knows a whole bunch about giants in the Forgotten Realms. Can we build a character that knows about giants, just not the scenario, which is where Nograt came from?
Yeah. So why have attitudes changed towards metagaming over the years? While there are still people that will say, oh, all metagaming is bad, in general, it's not considered quite that same vehemently evil as it used to be. Why?
So I think in some cases, and I will give 3rd edition credit for this, even if you are playing D&D as a kind of sort of tiny bit adversarial game to some extent, there is a feeling more in the hobby now that knowing how the rules work is very important. So in other words, even if you're metagaming and you're making this ridiculous character that knows exactly what to do, the DM should be adapting to challenge you as well. It's not just a matter of saying, I am going to take my module and go home because you metagamed, or I am going to have every merchant on the planet never sell you anything ever again, which is so ridiculous. It is something that was kind of saying, like, GMs have rules too. Yes, they can bend them, but, like, everybody has things that they should be abiding by, so talk about it and bring it back together, and don't worry about it as much if you can work through it.
I think a lot of it is the evolution of the hobby in general. We tend to think of, you know, D&D is its own specific game. Powered by the Apocalypse games are over there in their own bucket. Fate's off there in that bucket. Savage Worlds is over there. We tend to think of these things as separate entities. There's a lot of cross-pollination that happens about gaming ideas and gaming philosophy. We actually saw a lot of it in 5th edition when it came out, but that stuff came out of a lot of the indie games. I think because of the number of games out there that kind of take a step back and look at the story of the game and what we're doing in it on a more meta level, it has allowed for us to think about metagaming as something that, like, it's a natural part of role-playing. We are playing a game. Let's acknowledge that we're playing a game and play that game to the best of our abilities. And sometimes that means knowing how the game works beyond just what your character does or thinks.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that attitude does come from the entire ecosystem of RPGs outside of D&D, which then feeds back into D&D. You can't really play Fate or a Powered by the Apocalypse game without metagaming. There is some assumption there that you will be making some decisions for the entire sake of story and not because it is the optimized choice for your character.
Some, like in Fate, sometimes you want to lean into the negative aspects of your character because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's cool to have the characters lose and have to come back for that.
I'm also going to tell you a secret on how to win Fate, which I am somewhat joking about, but if you're playing through something that's a three-act structure, just keep compelling your worst attributes in the second act, get a ton of fate points, and then in the third act, you can invoke every aspect under the sun when you make your rolls. And that is actually the way storytelling works in general.
Yeah. I think actually that right there hits on some of it, is that we acknowledge the storytelling aspect of role-playing games on a more honest than I think we used to back in the 80s and early 90s. And we allow that sometimes you want to do things that are going to make for an interesting story, because if you do what would be good for just being a, like a board game, it's not going to be as interesting as a story for the characters.
Yeah. And I think, speaking of getting into the 90s, and the game ecosystem, I really think this did start to press in on D&D a little bit more, because not a lot of people remember this, but there were two RPGs that probably got within spitting distance of D&D, which doesn't happen very often. And one, I'm going to lump all of it together, but like the World of Darkness games definitely did. And also the West End game Star Wars RPG was huge for a while. And the funny thing about those is World of Darkness had a lot of mechanics where it was sort of like, we're going to track when you're getting corrupted, but it's not a thing like a paladin where you did something bad, therefore now you are fallen. It was more of a, how much can I push it? Can I do the bad thing and push it and still not suffer the consequences? Which does start to play into that metagame aspect of it, because you're thinking about the story of a vampire losing control, not just the mechanics of your character. And oh my gosh, West End game Star Wars was so metagamey to the point to where the adventure modules literally told you stuff that was happening on the deck of a Star Destroyer that none of your characters would ever know, so that you had a Star Wars experience.
I will say, like, those games, I don't think, like, they feel much more like an old school traditional game compared to modern games. But in the late 80s and 90s, they were a beast to themselves.
I also think there's one other thing that did probably shove D&D towards acknowledging a little bit more metagaming, and that is the popularity of D&D novels. Because now all of a sudden, people that were not DMs knew very deep lore about the setting, and they were reading about these heroes fighting specific D&D monsters and how to do it. And it's like, are you going to, in your products, say, please don't read our novels, or are you going to try and roll with it?
But there's a whole other argument. There's a whole other topic about whether D&D is story or game or whatever. And we've had arguments in the Gnome Stew Slack about this, because different people have different opinions. But I think those novels were basically saying, you know, we take the game out of it and just tell the story that would happen with these characters. That people loved it. That's what they kind of wanted out of their RPGs.
And lest anyone say that it was these horrible upstarts that introduced these gaming novels, like the evil Dragonlance setting that ruined the first edition vibe of everything. Gary Gygax wrote some of those novels about Greyhawk that explained these deep lore secrets about artifacts and stuff that Mordenkainen was doing. So Gygax was in on that from the start.
Yeah. Starting to wrap things up, what can players do to use metagaming for the power of good?
There have been times when I have been a player and I know something that my character wouldn't, that I have talked to the GM before and said, what if I know just enough to throw out this name but I don't know anything about it, and it gets the rest of the players to go after that. There are times when a player that has that metagame knowledge is an asset to the GM for pointing the story in the right direction.
I would say keep everyone at the table's fun in mind as you play. This means if you using that knowledge to kind of give everyone an advantage in this encounter and kind of screw over the GM's fun, maybe don't do that. Maybe let it happen and go from there. If you know of a way to keep things rolling and pulling in the other characters, that's all metagaming. Be a good player at the table. Make your GM want to have you at the table and make the other players enjoy your company. That's pretty much the best result of metagaming.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing I thought was funny was John in that Storm King's Thunder game also was like, every once in a while, I know you know the setting better than me, so I will let you tell me and everybody else what's going on, but I'll signal you. I'll let you know. Now is one of those times when you let us all know what's going on. Like, most of the game, just hang back and don't do this, but at certain points, like, I want more information, more context about these things, so just have at it.
Yep.
Now let's join Edge and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to the listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. But first, our Eldritch Invocation. We've got a Patreon now, so if you would like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we would love if you decided to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material, like the map that Chris has made for the campaign setting we're currently playing in. There's also spells and NPC classes and swords as magic items and all sorts of stuff all over the place. We've ranged wide in the stuff that we have released since this all started. I have been told by an intermediary from some of our patrons that we should not be soliciting for Eldritch Blasting anyone on behalf of anyone else. So I would just like to say we will not be Eldritch Blasting you if you decide to be our patrons, but we will hex someone for you.
So we're kind of on a Daggerheart kick lately. I really need to play this game soon because I certainly need to play it a little bit before I run it, because it is not one of those games that I think I can bumble my way through running to learn it. Anyway, Pointy Hat, yet another YouTuber, did a video about a short campaign he ran in Daggerheart and how it broke him in a very good way. He talks honestly about the things he liked and didn't like in the game, and then the frustration of how all those things were fixed before it was published. Anyway, it was a good watch. We'll have a link in the show notes.
It was kind of funny because I just watched Jenny D talking about Daggerheart too, and she said kind of the same thing where it's like, there were some things that kind of bugged me, but they fixed them. So they don't bug me, so there's no point in talking about them now. Keeping on our Daggerheart theme, Critical Role's Age of Umbra actual play series has begun. It's going to be an 8-episode campaign showcasing the Daggerheart rules, and it's going to have the original Critical Role cast all playing characters in it. The Age of Umbra setting is an Elden Ring Dark Souls type campaign setting, and it is one of the campaign frames that is in the Daggerheart core book. It should be interesting to see how this game plays with that very stylized, very dark, very grim type of setting, because that's kind of not the vibe that you get from some things that you've seen from Daggerheart so far, so I'm really interested to see this. By the time you hear this, you can probably watch the first episode on YouTube, and if you aren't catching it live on Twitch or on Critical Role's Beacon, then the next episode is probably about ready to come out too, so check it out.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast, Pandas Talking Games.
Queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Pandas, Phil, and Senda every other Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your game.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we'll hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.